Chapter 7. Self-exploration and therapy with psychedelics. Importance of set and setting. The history of attempts to use LSD and other psychedelics as therapeutic agents has been filled with trial and error. Although psychedelics have been used in many different ways, these efforts were initially met with very little success. A decisive turning point in this history, however, was the discovery of how the success or failure of the therapeutic experiment critically depends on extra pharmacological factors, which have been called the set and setting. These include who administers the substance, the personality of the subject, the intention and purpose of the experiment, the interpersonal and physical environment, and even the collective astrological transits and individual transits of the persons involved. Much of this confusion was caused by old paradigm thinking about a substance which, properly understood and used, offers unprecedented and revolutionary alternatives to conventional methods and strategies of therapy. The first suggestion that LSD might have therapeutic potential can be found in Werner Stoll's historic paper, LSD 25, A Fantasticum from the Ergot Group. In the context of Stoll's paper, the suggestion that the substance might be tried as a therapeutic agent appeared only as a fleeting comment, without any further specification. The first actual therapeutic experiment was reported 2 years later by Swiss psychiatrist and psychotherapist Jean Condreau. He explored the possibility that LSD might be an antidepressant and followed the formula for the treatment of depression by opium tincture. He administered increasing and then decreasing doses of the substance. The results were very disappointing. Condreau actually described occasional deepening rather than alleviation of symptoms. This is understandable since LSD, properly used, heals homeopathically by temporary intensification of symptoms. Equally disappointing were attempts of other researchers to follow this approach or use isolated medium dosages of LSD, testing its effects as a chemical antidepressant. Two therapeutic experiments were based on the clinical observation that acute psychotic episodes respond better to therapy than slowly developing episodes with few symptoms. The idea here was to use LSD as an agent, activating the symptoms and then applying real therapy. Thus, Yost and Vicari's failed attempt to use LSD seems, in retrospect, appalling and criminal to those of us who had personal experiences with this substance. These authors activated the symptoms of the patients with LSD and then applied electroshocks in the middle of their sessions. Sanderson, Spencer, and Whitelaw followed the same strategy, but used the administration of Thorazine instead of electroshocks. Another extreme example of using LSD in the spirit of the old paradigm was to apply it as a shock therapy, similar to electroconvulsive therapy and insulin comas, to administer it as a single overwhelming dose without any preparation or psychotherapy. The worst of these experiments was conducted in 1968 by Canadian psychiatrist Elliot Barker, assistant superintendent and clinical director at a maximum security hospital for the dangerous mentally ill in Ontario. Barker locked naked male offenders in a room for 11 days and gave them large amounts of LSD, 2,000 micrograms, in combination with anti-epileptics. They had to suck food through straws in the wall and were encouraged to express by screaming their violent fantasies. Recidivism actually significantly increased after this therapy. Barker was fired, but not because of his LSD experiments. It was in response to the inmates' rebellion against him. The increased recidivism of his experimental subjects also did not play a role in his firing. The follow-up was done at a later date. One of the programs that started as shock therapy actually changed into the form of therapy referred to as psychedelic, as used by many American and Canadian therapists. It consisted of a small number of sessions with large dosages of psychedelics, and the goal was to induce a transcendental experience. European therapists preferred a different approach, which was called psycholytic, resolving tensions and conflicts in the psyche, from the Greek lysis, meaning dissolution. It consisted of a long series of psychedelic sessions with low to medium dosages and was strongly influenced by Freud's psychoanalysis. The events that led to the development of true psychedelic therapy make it a fascinating story. In 1959, Dittman and Whittlesey published an article in the Archives of General Psychiatry that showed some superficial similarities between the LSD experience and delirium tremens. Canadian psychiatrists Abram Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond discussed this article while flying overnight on a red-eye express, and in a hypnagogic state of consciousness came up with the idea of using terrifying bad trips with LSD for the treatment of alcoholism. This was based on the clinical observation that the experience of delirium tremens is so horrible that it tends to deter alcoholics from further drinking, and often represents a radical turning point in their lives. Inspired by this discussion, Hoffer and Osmond started a program in their hospital in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which was designed to induce the worst possible experiences, bad trips, in alcoholic patients by trying to mimic delirium tremens through the administration of LSD. Then the story became even more interesting when the legendary Al Hubbard, the most mysterious person in psychedelic history, unexpectedly appeared on the scene. It is very difficult to adequately describe Al Hubbard. His biography reads like a script for a Hollywood action movie. In 1919, when he was not yet 20 years old, Hubbard, allegedly guided by otherworldly forces, invented the Hubbard Energy Transformer. It was a battery that allegedly drew energy directly from a radioactive ore. Its technology could not be explained by the science of the day. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer reported that Hubbard's invention, hidden in a small box, 11 inches by 14 inches, had powered a ferry-sized vessel around Seattle's Portico Bay nonstop for 3 days. Hubbard sold 50% of the patent to the Radium Corporation of Pittsburgh for $75,000. The list of his affiliations and jobs is extraordinary. At various times, he worked for the Canadian Special Services, the United States Justice Department, the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, the Office of Strategic Services, and allegedly also for the CIA. During Prohibition, he had a job as a Seattle taxi driver. With a sophisticated ship-to-shore communication system hidden in the trunk of his cab, he helped rum runners successfully ferry booze past the U.S. and Canadian coast guards. He was proclaimed the bootleg king of the Northwest, then was caught by the FBI, and went to prison for 18 months. For a short time, he also held a job as janitor at the Stanford Research Institute in California. In his early 40s, Hubbard realized his lifelong ambition of becoming a millionaire. By 1950, he was the scientific director of the Uranium Corporation of Vancouver, owned his own fleet of aircraft, a 100-foot yacht, and Damon Island on Vancouver Bay. His nickname, Captain Hubbard, came from his Master of Sea Vessel certification and a stint in the U.S. Merchant Marine Institute. He also had another nickname, Johnny Appleseed of LSD, because he gave LSD to an estimated 6,000 people, including scientists, politicians, intelligence officials, diplomats, and church figures. According to his friends, he was able to hold naked wires from a 120-volt socket, encouraging them to do the same. When they got shocked, he gave them the advice, "You cannot fight electricity, you have to go with it." Hubbard kept appearing and disappearing at different places, carrying a small black briefcase, and had the reputation of being able to bilocate. In 1953, Al Hubbard surprised Humphrey Osmond by inviting him for lunch at the Royal Vancouver Yacht Club. During their discussion, Hubbard expressed strong criticism of the therapeutic strategy that Osmond and Hoffer were using in their LSD treatment for alcoholics. He insisted that the approach should be the exact opposite. What these patients needed was a profound life-transforming transcendental experience. To achieve it, they should run sessions in a beautiful setting, decorated with flowers and universal spiritual symbols, and play spiritual music. Hoffer and Osmond followed his advice, and the treatment results improved considerably. This strategy became the standard for LSD treatment of alcoholics and addicts in Canada and the United States under the somewhat tautological name psychedelic therapy. In the mid-1960s, the Czechoslovakian pharmaceutical company Spofa, the only producer of pure LSD besides the Swiss Sandoz, sent Al Hubbard to me to be interviewed. They wanted me to tell them if Hubbard was known in scientific circles, since he came to Prague to purchase 2 grams of LSD for the Hollywood Hospital in Vancouver. The fact that he had co-written a paper entitled The Psychedelic Experience with Myron Stolaroff and Willis Harmon turned out to be adequate proof of his legitimacy for the Czech authorities. His purchase of 2 grams of Czech LSD was a bargain. At that time, an ampule with 100 micrograms cost 10 U.S. cents. During our discussion, Al opened his black briefcase and showed me authorized documents from both the U.S. and Canadian governments, allowing him to transport any substances across the borders of these two countries. I also got the chance to ask him a question that had been on my mind since I had heard about his advice on the use of LSD he had given to Osmond and Hoffer. How did he obtain that information? The answer was fascinating. He told me that 10 years before Albert Hoffman discovered the psychedelic effects of LSD, he, Al Hubbard, had a vision of an archetypal angelic being who told him that a unique substance would be discovered in Switzerland and described the way it should be used. In the summer of 1967, during my visit to Palo Alto, California, psychedelic pioneer Myron Stolaroff invited me to join him on a trip in his Cessna 4-seater airplane to visit his close friend, Al Hubbard. We flew over the Sierra Nevada mountain range and visited Al in his rocky retreat in Onion Valley. The three of us took an afternoon hiking trip in the mountains, during which Myron kept telling me fascinating stories about Al's life and abilities. At one point, to my surprise, he told me that he saw him as a great spiritual being who was on par with Jesus Christ. The general conclusion from the early therapeutic experiments with LSD was that this substance is not per se a chemotherapeutic agent. To be effective, it has to be administered in combination with psychotherapy and in a specially structured environment. But even here, the history of trials and errors continued. When LSD was administered in small dosages as an adjunct to psychotherapy in a series of sessions, it did not noticeably enhance the therapeutic process. Instead, it significantly prolonged the sessions and occasionally actually intensified the symptoms. It was definitely better to reverse the emphasis, to increase the dose of LSD and use psychotherapy for processing and integration of the experience. Another unsuccessful therapeutic attempt was hypnodelic therapy, a procedure developed by Levine and Ludwig for the treatment of alcoholics and drug addicts. It was a combination of LSD administration and hypnosis. The patients were trained as hypnotic subjects, and the latency period of the psychedelic effect was used for the induction of hypnosis. The idea was that at the time of the onset of the substance's effect, the patients would be in a hypnotic trance. Hypnotic suggestions could then be used to encourage them to let go, surrender to the experience, overcome feelings of fear, and direct them to specific aspects of their biography. The procedure was complex and time-consuming, requiring hypnotic training of both the clients and the experimenters, and it did not bring the expected favorable effects. An ambitious, though poorly conceived, study testing the results of hypnodelic therapy brought devastating results. The authors assigned 176 patients to one of four groups. 1, psychedelic therapy with LSD. 2, hypnodelic therapy. 3, administration of medium doses of LSD alone. 4, no specific therapy, just milieu therapy. In addition, half of each group received the medication antabuse after the termination of treatment. The authors did not find any difference in therapeutic results between any of the groups, and the overall remission rate was extremely low. In a 6-month follow-up, between 70% and 80% of the patients were drinking, and in the 1-year follow-up, this number rose to between 80% and 90%. Therapists in the study were mostly unmotivated residents, inadequately trained in any of the used modalities. An incisive critique of this study by Charles Savage can be found in my book, LSD Psychotherapy. Some therapists, inspired by the early work of Sigmund Freud and Joseph Breuer, explored the possibility of using LSD as an abreactive agent. But this did not find acceptance as a specialized form of LSD therapy. Abreaction became very popular in World War II for the treatment of traumatic war neuroses, but was declared ineffective in the therapy of psychoneuroses. LSD brought abreaction back to therapy as an important therapeutic mechanism, but not as a prime goal or specific treatment modality. London psychoanalysts Joyce Martin and Pauline McCrerick developed a very interesting procedure, which they called fusion therapy. It was designed for the treatment of patients who suffered childhood abandonment and emotional deprivation in their infancy. Joyce and Pauline administered medium dosages of LSD to their clients and had them lie on a couch in a semi-darkened room covered with a blanket. They then positioned their bodies parallel to the clients' bodies and held them in close embrace, like a good mother would do with her child. Pauline and Joyce's 1965 presentation at the Amityville Conference on LSD Psychotherapy effectively dichotomized the therapists in the audience who were listening to their lecture and watching their video. Some of these therapists considered the fusion therapy as a very logical approach to a serious clinical problem that is beyond the reach of verbal therapy. Others abhorred the danger that such close contact between the therapist and client would cause to the transference-counter-transference relationship. Fusion therapy did not become a therapeutic trend and remained a unique experiment of two women, which was closely connected to their extraordinary personalities. Therapists, particularly men, did not feel comfortable venturing into this new risky territory behind the closed doors of their private offices. I had the opportunity to spend a week in London with Pauline and Joyce in their clinic on Welbeck Street, as well as a chance to experience two sessions of fusion therapy with Pauline, one in London, the other in Amsterdam. My own experiences and interviews with their patients convinced me that this was a very effective way of healing the trauma caused by anaclitic deprivation, or what I called trauma by omission. I introduced the fusion therapy into our work with psychedelics and also into the breathwork workshops and training, and found it remarkably effective and helpful. My experiences and adventures with Pauline are described in the chapter The Dying Queen in my book When the Impossible Happens. The initial attempts to use LSD in group therapy were also unsuccessful. Small dosages given to patients in Eric Berne's type of transactional analysis did not seem to improve the group dynamics in any significant way. When the dosages were increased, the patients tended to focus on their own experiences, lost interest in focused group work, and many of them disappeared into their inner world. Eventually, group therapy with psychedelics developed in two directions. One, aggregate psychedelic therapy, in which a large number of people took psychedelic substances together, but there was no effort during the sessions to work with the group as a whole. The main advantage of this approach is economical, considering the difference in the ratio between the number of the therapists or facilitators and the number of group participants. This approach is particularly useful in groups of experienced individuals who do not need much assistance and are capable of tolerating the noises made by other participants and can integrate them into their own experience. Under these circumstances, teams of two skilled facilitators have been able to work with groups of 14 to 16 people, particularly if these groups were meeting repeatedly and their members had developed a sense of community and mutual trust. The efficacy of this type of work can be enhanced if it is complemented with post-session group sharing and processing work. An extreme example of aggregate psychedelic therapy was psychosynthesis, the marathon group psychotherapy process developed by Mexican psychiatrist Salvador Roquette. Not to be confused with the psychospiritual system of the same name created by Italian psychotherapist Roberto Assagioli. Under Salvador's guidance, large groups of people, up to 30, met in all-night sessions, convivials. Participants were carefully selected with the explicit intention to make the group as heterogeneous as possible with regard to gender, age, clinical picture, length of previous treatment, and the psychedelic substance administered. Some of the clients received medicinal plants, such as a variety of psilocybin-containing mushrooms, peyote, and Datura serotocaulum, while others were given psychedelic substances such as LSD and ketamine. The purpose of the selection process was to provide a wide range of experiences and people for projection and imaginary roles. paternal figures, sibling substitutes, and sexual objects. During the sessions, Salvador subjected group participants to a sensory overload using disturbing, emotionally evocative films featuring images from Nazi Germany and sexual, aggressive, and sadomasochistic scenes. Salvador's goal was to facilitate the experiences of ego death and rebirth. He had an eccentric personality and was a very controversial figure among his colleagues. He invited a group of Mexican psychiatrists and psychologists to a party in his home and served, unbeknownst to them, sandwiches with psychedelic mushrooms. Salvador's therapeutic strategy was closely tied to his personality and remained a curiosity in psychedelic history. Encouraging projection and using external stimuli for enforcing a specific type of experience tends to take the subject's attention away from focused introspection and interferes with the spontaneous self-healing intelligence of the psyche. The unconscious certainly has the capacity to take us to the dark recesses of our unconscious, including the experience of annihilation, death, and rebirth, if that is a natural trajectory of the healing process. Attempts to create a bad trip and facilitate disintegration can be a deterrent, however, and discourage patients from continuing therapy. This strategy might also interfere with the trajectory of a session that would otherwise take the person to a deeply ecstatic and healing mystical experience, a Neptunian rather than Plutonic type of transpersonal experience. In 1974, Roquette was charged with drug trafficking and crimes against the health of his patients. The charges were dropped on April 10, 1975, after a Supreme Court trial during which he was declared not guilty. He also spent 9 months in the infamous Black Palace, Palacio de Lecumberri, Mexico City's prison of no escape. 2. Psychedelic rituals. The second way of utilizing psychedelic substances in groups is in the form of a ritual, which is the way they are used in many Native cultures, the use of peyote in the Native American church and by the Huichol Indians, of psilocybe mushrooms by the Mazatecs, of ayahuasca by ayahuasqueros, members of the Santo Daime religion, and Uneao do Vegetal in Brazil, or of iboga by natives in Central Africa. These ritual events are usually structured. They might require special attire, maintaining a certain position, prescribed forms of behavior, group dancing or chanting, etc. British anthropologist Victor Turner, who dedicated his life to the study of Native rituals, concluded that people who share participation in rituals involving holotropic states of consciousness tend to develop strong bonding or a sense of communitas. For this reason, this modality could be very important for industrial civilizations, since one of the most salient features of modern society is alienation. We are alienated from our bodies, from each other, from nature, from the universe, and from the divine. Rituals using psychedelics or other forms of holotropic states could become a powerful way of overcoming alienation. The holotropic state of consciousness experienced by the participants in a ritual also lifts the situation out of the everyday context. It dissolves the hierarchical structure of the society, at least for the time of the ritual, and creates a sense of equality. It is important to point out that Native group rituals have profound social dynamics and are interesting from the anthropological point of view. However, because of their mostly extroverted orientation, they are usually not conducive to deeply focused self-exploration. In the course of the complicated history described above, the use of LSD for self-exploration and psychotherapy for individuals developed into two main modalities, psycholytic therapy and psychedelic therapy. 1. Psycholytic therapy is a name that was coined by British psychiatrist and psychotherapist Ronald Sanderson. It refers to releasing tensions and resolving conflicts in the psyche. It has been used mostly by European therapists. Hans Karl Leuner, Wilhelm Aronson Hein, John Buckman and Thomas M. Ling, Milan Hausner, Yaraj and Sonia Stick, Peter Baumann, Peter Gasser, and others. It is based on psychoanalytic theory, but without the principles and restrictions of Freudian praxis, such as the therapist's position, prohibition of acting out, not answering questions, strategic use of silence, not touching, etc. Psycholytic treatment consists of a series of 15 to 100 sessions with medium dosages of LSD-25 in 1 to 2 week intervals. The type and extent of support provided for patients during the sessions varies. I myself stayed with my patients for 5 to 6 hours and then put them into the care of my nurses, who all had experience training sessions with LSD, and of other patients in the ward who were all participating in the research and had personal experiences with LSD. Hans Karl Leuner's system was on the other side of the spectrum. His patients were generally left alone and could use a bell to call the nurses if they needed help. The rest of the therapists whom I knew personally were somewhere in between. They spent part of the sessions with the clients and used nurses and students as sitters. Many of the psycholytic therapists kept verbal contact with the patients. They expected a report from them about their experience and made occasional comments or even attempted to offer interpretations. The patients were allowed to keep their eyes open, make eye contact with the therapist, and look around. They were encouraged to describe what they were seeing and how their perception of the world was being affected. Many therapists also asked the patients to bring photographs of their spouses, partners, and members of their family of origin to the sessions and look at them in the later stages of their experience. The psycholytic strategy had its advantages and drawbacks. It was ideal for the exploration of the dynamics of the psyche. When I used it in the early stage of my research, it made it possible for me to explore sequentially different levels of the unconscious. It was a process that one of my patients called chemoarchaeology, and another, the onion peeling of the unconscious. I was also able to study and understand the logic of the optical illusions that my patients were experiencing. Why they saw me and the environment transformed in a particular way at different times of their sessions and stages of their therapy. I collected literally hundreds of examples of this process, which showed the determination and overdetermination of LSD visions and optical illusions. They involved essentially the same mechanisms that Freud found when he was analyzing the dream work. I described and explained many of these transformations in my book, Realms of the Human Unconscious. The most important and valuable yield from this research strategy was the discovery of the self-healing intelligence of the psyche, which guided the therapeutic process to the most important unconscious memories underlying the symptoms. The gradual unfolding of the psyche in sequential sessions provided a unique opportunity for charting a new map of the psyche and discovering its dynamic governing principles. COEX systems, basic perinatal matrices, BPMs, and archetypal templates in the collective unconscious. However, the use of lower dosages, the fact that the patient spent significant parts of the session with their eyes open, and frequent talking were not the most effective way to achieve positive and fast therapeutic results. I realized that the price which I paid for my curiosity and for these fascinating insights was the slowing down of therapeutic progress. This strategy diverted the process of focused vertical explorations, which is the most effective method for finding the causes of emotional problems, to horizontal probing. This was intellectually interesting for me as well as my patients, but also unfortunately served the patient's resistance and avoidance of deeper painful issues. When I realized that, I changed the strategy of therapy. I increased the dosages and internalized the sessions by introducing eye shades, limiting the verbal exchange, and using music to deepen the experience. This modification brought the strategy close to the psychedelic therapy developed in Canada that I described earlier. 2. Psychedelic therapy is the other popular way of conducting treatment with psychedelic substances. It consists of a small number of sessions with large doses of LSD, 400 to 600 micrograms, a single overwhelming dose. The experiences are strictly internalized by the use of eye shades and headphones. The treatment rooms are decorated with beautiful paintings and flowers, and high-fidelity spiritual music is played throughout the sessions. Supervision is usually provided by two facilitators, preferably a male and female team. Preparation for the sessions consists of several hours of drug-free interviews. The purpose of these sessions is getting to know the patient's life histories and their symptoms, developing a good therapeutic relationship, and explaining to them the effects of the psychedelic substance they will receive. After the sessions, the therapists schedule drug-free interviews to discuss the patient's experiences and help them with the integration. This approach has been practiced mostly by Canadian and American therapists: Abram Hoffer, Humphrey Osmond, Ross McLean, Duncan Blewett, Ralph Metzner, Richard Alpert, Timothy Leary, Myron Stolaroff, James Fadiman, Robert Mogar, Willis Harmon, and others. We also use this strategy in our projects at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, MPCR, in the treatment of neurotics, alcoholics, narcotic drug addicts, and cancer patients, as well as in the LSD training sessions of mental health professionals. Using this approach brings very impressive therapeutic results. The life of many patients can be dramatically changed by 1 to 3 psychedelic sessions, but the mechanisms of this change remain obscure. This situation resembles the changes that David Rosen found in survivors of suicidal jumps from the Golden Gate Bridge and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. However, using the observations from serial psycholytic sessions, it became possible to imagine that the mechanisms underlying these changes might be accelerated and intensified by the high-dose psychedelic therapy and therefore produce these results. Representatives of the two approaches of using psychedelic substances expressed criticisms of the opposing camp. Psycholytic therapists argued that psychedelic therapists avoid important biographical issues and cause spiritual bypass. psychedelic therapists criticize psycholytic therapists for nitpicking, dwelling unnecessarily on unimportant biographical issues, and wasting the opportunity for a life-transforming psychedelic peak experience. After this brief historical review of the therapeutic experiments with LSD, we can now discuss the basic principles that increase the benefits and reduce the potential risks of using LSD. Many of these principles apply to other psychedelics as well. Microdosing with LSD. We can start with microdosing, a strategy which has been recommended and researched by James Fadiman. Jim is currently conducting a study on microdosing with LSD in order to improve normal functioning. Microdosing, or sub-perceptual dosing, means taking a sub-threshold dose, which for LSD is 10 to 20 micrograms. The purpose of microdosing is not to experience a non-ordinary state of consciousness, but to enhance normal cognitive and executive functionality. Nootropic effect. In this study, the volunteers self-administer the drug approximately every third day. They then self-report perceived effects on their daily duties and relationships. Volunteers participating in this study include a wide variety of scientific and artistic professionals and students. So far, the report suggests that, in general, the subjects experience normal functioning, but with increased focus, creativity, and emotional clarity, as well as slightly enhanced physical performance. Albert Hofmann was aware of microdosing and called it the most under-researched area of psychedelics. Recreational use of LSD and other psychedelics. People who know their reaction to LSD can take small doses, 25 to 75 micrograms, to enhance their perception in natural settings, as long as they know the quality and dose of the substance they are taking and their reaction to it. For most people, this dosage range does not interfere with ordinary everyday functioning, with the exception of driving. It can greatly enhance the experience of hiking, swimming in a river, lake, or ocean, and bring a new dimension to lovemaking. Sharing this experience with like-minded friends, listening to music, enjoying good food, and talking about philosophical and spiritual matters can create very special social events. The model for such parties was set by the Club de Hashishins, or Club of the Hashish Eaters, a Parisian group dedicated to the exploration of drug-induced experiences. It counted among its members the French intellectual elite, including Victor Hugo, Alexandre Dumas, Charles Baudelaire, Gérard de Nerval, Eugène Delacroix, Théophile Gautier, and Honoré de Balzac. Before we embark on the recreational use of psychedelics, it is essential that we test our response to the psychedelic substance of choice in private. The individual response to psychedelics varies greatly, and for some people, even the moderate dosages mentioned above can trigger an unexpectedly strong reaction. Psychotherapy and self-exploration with psychedelics. Once we move to higher dosages, which can activate deep levels of the unconscious, the most productive and safest sessions seem to be those that are internalized, involving minimum contact with the external world, with the exception of music. It is important to be in a secluded place where one is not disturbed by external noises and has the freedom to express anything that needs to be expressed. To have a safe and healing session, it is also essential to have a sitter, a person who has had personal experiences with psychedelics and feels comfortable with the process. Although I am aware that many readers take psychedelics under various conditions for self-exploration or spiritual quest, I will describe here how we conducted sessions with people who had significant emotional problems and came to us for therapy. Some of these precautions would be useful even for sessions run outside of the therapeutic context. A necessary prerequisite for any work with psychedelics or other methods involving holotropic states of consciousness is a good medical examination. Above all, we need to know if the person is in good cardiovascular condition. It is difficult to predict how intense the emotions that the psychedelic substance will elicit may be. High uncontrolled blood pressure, cardiac arrhythmia, history of strokes or heart attacks, or presence of an aneurysm could be a serious risk. While LSD is biologically a very safe substance, the use of entheogens related to amphetamine, such as MDA, MMDA, MDMA, etc., significantly increases the danger of a cardiovascular episode. The doses should stay in a reasonable range, and people with cardiovascular problems should never take substances belonging to this group. There have been reports of fatalities in cases where these precautions were not respected. Another consideration is the overall physical condition of the person who is taking a psychedelic substance. The sessions, particularly with high dosages, can be emotionally and physically demanding. Current debilitating disease or exhaustion after a disease, recent operations or injuries can represent a contraindication. Such situations have to be individually evaluated. In our Maryland program of LSD therapy for terminal cancer patients, we only screened out patients who had serious cardiovascular problems. Out of more than 200 patients, none died in the session or experienced any physical emergency. And yet, one of these patients died 4 days after the session. He had skin cancer that had metastasized all through his body, but he had a paralyzing fear of death and seemed to be desperately hanging on to life. In the session, he had a powerful experience of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth that liberated him from this fear. He died peacefully 4 days later. After some initial attempts, we decided not to run sessions with patients who had brain tumors. Their experiences seemed to be disjointed and confused, and they had difficulties with the conceptual integration of the content. Pregnancy, particularly when advanced, represents a relative contraindication. Women who experience the reliving of their own birth also often experience themselves as delivering. This actually involves the strong contraction of the uterus. I have worked with women who, in a session combining birth and delivery, started menstruating in the middle of their cycle. Such contractions could possibly cause premature delivery. Over the years, I have allowed many pregnant women to do holotropic breathwork, but we had the agreement that they would not continue if the process began to take the form of birth delivery. In psychedelic therapy, one cannot make such an agreement, and it is wise not to work with women while they are pregnant. However, the postpartum period is an excellent time for psychedelic sessions, since pregnancy and delivery activate the perinatal memories and make them more available. A good completion of the session often requires bodywork. There are conditions that might require limitation or modification of physical interventions, including post-fracture or post-operation, vertebral disc prolapse, whiplash, osteoporosis, diaphragmatic or umbilical hernia, colostomy, etc. Blockages or pains near the genital area cannot be released by direct bodywork. However, they can be reached indirectly by working with the legs the way it was described in the chapter on holotropic breathwork. Another important consideration is the emotional condition of the person who is coming to a psychedelic session or holotropic breathwork. If this person has a history of psychiatric hospitalization, particularly a longer one, it is necessary to find out what was the nature of this disorder, what form it took, and the circumstances that led to it. This evaluation has to be done by a person who is familiar with traditional psychiatry and also with transpersonal psychology. In many instances, the condition that was diagnosed as a psychotic episode was a misdiagnosed spiritual emergency. In that case, we did not hesitate to accept such a person into a holotropic breathwork workshop or into psychedelic therapy, and they usually did not cause any special problems. Ideally, the therapists or sitters should know the history of the person whom they will accompany in the session, the nature of their prenatal life and birth, if the information is available, the quality of the care they received in their infancy and childhood, main events in their lives, the traumas they remember, and the conflicts of which they are aware. It is very useful to find out if there are any repetitive patterns in their lives concerning relationships with certain categories of people, such as authorities, peers, men or women, interpersonal coex systems. These tend to be activated and replicated in the sessions and can create problems. An important function of the pre-session interviews is to establish a good working relationship and trust. If the candidate for the session does not already have information about the effect of the substance they are about to take and about the nature of the experience, we have to briefly provide it. This involves the length of the session, the need to keep the session interiorized, agreement on how we will communicate, and the main categories of experiences they might encounter. Even if the intellectual information about perinatal and transpersonal experiences cannot adequately convey their power and impact, it is extremely important and useful to know about their existence and the form they take. We have to correct the misconceptions of Western civilization and mainstream psychiatry concerning what is normal and what is crazy. People need to know that such experiences as reliving one's birth or episodes of prenatal life, ancestral, phylogenetic, and past life memories, or encounters with archetypal beings and visits to archetypal realms are perfectly normal aspects of the experiential spectrum of holotropic states of consciousness. Experiencing them can expand our worldview and be important components in the process of spiritual opening and inner transformation. Naturally, a critically important element in psychonautics with psychedelics is the nature of the substance we are using and its quality, as well as its dosage. Under current circumstances, unless a reliable source of pure chemicals is available, the best choice might be plant medicines. In some states and countries, one is allowed to grow one's own marijuana, psilocybe mushrooms, peyote, or ayahuasca. The parotid and skin secretions of the toad Bufo alvarius can be obtained from experienced and honest healers. Street samples of substances purchased on the black market represent a gamble and can be dangerous. One can never be sure about the nature of the substance, its dose, and quality. In the 1970s, Stanley Krippner analyzed street samples of alleged LSD and reported the results. The analysis showed the presence of 18 contaminants, including amphetamines, angel dust, small amounts of strychnine, and even urine. Unfortunately, various degrees of uncertainty will continue to plague psychonauts until psychedelics are decriminalized and available in pure form. In spite of the current renaissance of interest in psychedelics, people who would like to have a legal psychedelic session have to fit in one of the research categories, such as patients with cancer, PTSD, migraine headaches, anxiety states, etc. Unless testing or comparing various dosages is our intention or is required by our research design, it is preferable to use higher dosages of LSD, around 250 to 500 micrograms. It might mean a somewhat more demanding management of the sessions, but it brings faster and better results, and it is safer. Lower dosages tend to activate the symptoms and not bring the experience to a good resolution because they make it easier to use defense mechanisms. Higher dosages thus usually bring a cleaner resolution. In the higher dosage range, it is important to keep the session internalized. This makes it possible to see and understand what is emerging from the unconscious and what we are dealing with. Leaving the eyes open and interacting with the environment in high-dose LSD sessions is dangerous and unproductive. It confuses and mixes the inner and outer and makes self-exploration impossible. I have met people who have taken LSD hundreds of times and had not discovered that the experience had anything to do with their own unconscious. For them, it was like going to a strange movie, where they saw colors and patterns, everything was moving, people's faces and the environment were strangely distorted, and they experienced intense but incomprehensible waves of emotion. Such use of LSD is dangerous and is conducive to poorly resolved experiences, prolonged reactions, and flashbacks or worse. Safe psychonautics requires undivided attention to one's unconscious material as it is emerging, the full experience of emotions, and the processing of the content. The ideal situation for therapeutic sessions is a protected environment which allows the client to make noises if necessary and includes the presence of a male-female duo of facilitators or sitters. We keep the experience internalized by using eye shades and keeping the verbal interaction and interventions at a minimum, unless the client initiates or asks for it. If the person interrupts the experience and opens their eyes, we try to do what it takes to gently persuade them to return to introspection. Playing music through the session can help the client stay in the flow of the experience and move through possible impasses. It can also activate and bring deep emotions to the surface. The choice and use of music is similar to how it was described in the chapter on holotropic breathwork. The general principle is to closely support what is happening in the session rather than trying to program the experience in a specific way. We can get the necessary clues from observing the facial expressions, occasional verbal comments, and body language, which may include sensual movement of the pelvis, clenched fists and jaws, a relaxed position and blissful smile, uttering the name of the country in which the experience unfolds, etc. We can also follow the general course or trajectory of the LSD session. The intensity of the music gradually increases, reaching a climax around 3 hours into the experience, and then becomes more emotional, comforting, and feminine. In the final stage of the session, the music becomes timeless, flowing, meditative, and quiet. We tend to avoid pieces of music which are well known and would guide the experience in a specific way, as well as vocal performances in languages that the client knows. If we use recordings of human voices, they should be perceived just as sounds of musical instruments and not convey any specific verbal message. About 5 hours into the session, it is useful to take a break and get a brief verbal report about the client's experience. This might also be a good time to move outside. Ideally, the psychedelic sessions would be held in a beautiful environment, in the mountains, near a park, meadow, forest, river, lake, or ocean. In the termination period of a psychedelic session, taking a shower or bath or swimming in water can be an ecstatic and healing experience. This period can facilitate regression to a prenatal state and even take our experience to the beginning of life in the primeval ocean. Depending on the place and the time of day, we might want to take the client to a place where we can watch the sunset, the moon, or the night sky. If we do not have the luxury of any of the above, we try to find as much of a natural setting as we can. Psychedelic experiences tend to connect us with nature and make us realize how deeply we are connected and embedded within it, as well as how much the industrial civilization has obscured this and alienated us. If the session does not reach a good closure, it is essential to use bodywork to release any residual emotions or physical tensions and blockages. However, I have been able to find very few psychedelic therapists who are actually using this. The principles are the same as was described in the chapter on holotropic breathwork. We do not use any preconceived techniques, but let ourselves be guided by the healing intelligence of the client's own psyche. We find the best possible ways to accentuate the existing symptoms and encourage him or her to fully express whatever this brings. In our therapeutic and training programs at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, we organized family reunions in the later hours of psychedelic sessions. The patients would invite partners, spouses, family members, or friends of their choice for these events. We would order meals from a nearby Chinese or Japanese restaurant, which had interesting tastes, textures, and colors, and we all shared a dinner, listening to quiet music. At this time, the clients were still in holotropic states of consciousness, which can remarkably enhance the quality of sensory perception. By directing this opening of the doors of perception, to use Aldous Huxley's term, to objects and activities of everyday life, they learned new ways to experience nature, watch sunsets, taste food, listen to music, and interact with people. In spite of its complicated history, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy has shown its great potential in the treatment of phobias, depression, psychosomatic disorders, and physical pain. Using LSD as a catalyst, it became possible to extend the range of applicability of psychotherapy to categories of patients that previously had been difficult to reach: alcoholics, narcotic drug addicts, sexual deviants, and criminal recidivists. The current extraordinary renaissance of interest in psychedelics will hopefully make it possible to use all the clinical experiences that have lain dormant for 40 years, avoid the mistakes of the past, and have a fresh new start. I have no doubt that the new research will confirm that psychedelics are unique therapeutic agents of an entirely new kind, unparalleled in the history of psychiatry.